Tyson, I still can't hear you. This might be a very intimate conversation with John Marucci and Dr. Finlayson Feist.
Last time we were had went 3 down to 2, now we're 2 down to 1.
It's like a murder mystery.
Professor Franklin's to give us strength in our bodies.
Hello and welcome to Bless the Refreshments, where normal people have normal conversations about the gospel, making it way more fun and interesting to be a member of the church. So this is our last episode of season 2, and while it has been a different experience than season 1, we're very grateful for the time you spent with us. Our hiatus this year will likely be pretty similar to last year. We'll take the summer and be back in the fall. So make sure you're subscribed to the show wherever you listen, so you can catch when we publish our first episode of season 3. We wanted to go out with a bang this year, so we invited Dr. Jennifer Finlayson Fife back on the show. Remember episode 2 of this season when someone responded to our NGL episode and asked for advice about dating post-divorce, and we responded imperfectly? That experience stuck with us, and we wanted to ask for help. We talked with Dr. Finlayson Fife about navigating a marriage that's on the rocks, what the divorce process looks like, and how you can help those going through divorce. We hope you enjoy our last episode of season 2.
Thanks for joining us again. Burgess sends his regards. He is not well today. So again, you get 2 out of the 3 of us again, which happened last time.
Oh, yeah. <That's>
we got 3 for 5 minutes at least.
So. Oh, that's right. I remember that now. Yeah, that's right.
Today, we wanted to get your expert help on divorce. How this kind of came about is last year, I don't know if you did the not gonna lie thing on Instagram where people would send through anonymous questions, and we made an episode about it. And one of them said was regarding dating after divorce. The three of us were like, we have no idea. We don't know how to do it. And that kind of ate at me. And I was like, I wish I had better advice. I wish we could talk about this more, in the church and as friends. It's just hard to, talk about.
Yeah, for sure.
So, I think that you are an expert. I would consider you an expert. So again, if we could get, you could help us navigate this. So, I mean, I guess I don't know where to start with this, but I guess if you're in a marriage that is struggling, what are some signs that you should start considering divorce? When should you stick it out?
Gosh, these are hard answers because often the people that should divorce don't hear it, and the ones that shouldn't do hear it. So it's a little tricky thing because often people who want to believe that they are the problem and want to believe that if they try a little harder or something, the issue will be solved are often over-functioning at the cost of the marriage either having a chance to shift or at the cost of awakening them to the fact that it's a marriage that will not grow. So, and then often the ones who think they're pulling so hard and doing everything are often a little more narcissistic and don't see their participation in their own misery to only divorce and go recreate it in another relationship. Right. It can be a little tricky, but, obviously I'm going to say in abusive situations, right? Mm-hmm. Unless the person who is being abusive is really able to self-confront and change the behavior and deal with themselves, right? It is a dangerous place to be, especially psychological abuse, because hanging out with somebody who keeps telling you you're worthless, you don't deserve anything, everything's your fault, it's very hard for the human mind when someone matters to you that much to get clear about who you really are when you have a constant input of somebody who's mind twisting and twisting reality. It gets a little trickier, but still is worth the consideration. Is if you are with someone who will not self-confront, it doesn't have to be abusive, but won't grow, won't face themselves, won't deal with the way that they're participating in the unhappiness of the marriage. Now, as I've said before on podcasts, like one of the things I've said to my kids that is really, really important in finding a marriage partner is to both be someone and find someone who is willing to face themselves honestly. When you're getting honest feedback about who you are, that and how you're impacting those around you, that you're willing to honestly deal with who you are. Because if that's not operating in both people, then the marriage doesn't have a growth mechanism within it. And it means that the marriage will suffer, that the people in the marriage will suffer, because to create a marriage, it must be a growing organism. It must be something that can adapt and respond. And often the less healthy people are, the more trauma, in a sense, that's not quite the right word, but the more of a kind of nuclear bomb going off that is required to get the people in the marriage to address themselves. So sometimes I've worked with couples in which one person is willing to face themselves and the other person simply is not. And I think that working with people in those situations, I never am telling them to get a divorce because they alone live in the consequences of their choices. But I am trying to perhaps disabuse them of the idea that their partner will eventually want to face themselves or want to do the work of addressing how they're impacting the happiness of their spouse. You know, I've worked with people where they have decided, perhaps after the kids have left, that they can't any longer stay in the marriage or keep choosing it and decide to leave it.
You've said a lot of interesting things in there, and I think it all goes back to when we first had you on a couple of years ago. Our question was, how to suck less as a spouse, right?
Yes.
And your first thing you ever said to us was, "No, you're going to suck," and being able to self confront. So I think that's a big thing. How do you see? What does it look like? I guess when someone does that, or I guess refuses to do that, like what kind of conversations do they have? What kind of signs do you see that someone isn't really willing to self-confront?
Well, they're very defensive. I mean, they're all, it's always, I do this, I suck because you suck. Okay. Like, yeah, I might do that, but that's because you do this. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't then sometimes something to deal with in what the spouse is saying. And if you're part of the sucky equation, you want to deal with your half. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's kind of like, it's never me. It's always you. And that's how I'm going to keep my focus on you as a way to get away from me.
Sure.
But basically how I think of it is you're mind twisting. You're always screwing with reality. So your spouse comes and says, "Hey, this is a problem." And instead of dealing with what they're saying, you twist it and get it onto turf that you can prevail on and get the conversation away from the issue. And often people are doing this intuitively, instinctively. They've watched their parents do it. It's even their limbic brain trying to get them away from the terror of, "Hey, maybe I suck." And so when they do that, they're basically very difficult to have a conversation with, because they won't deal with the plain message that's coming towards them. And they're always trying to turn it into a justification.
Sure.
Self-confrontation is not saying I'm sorry. Self-confrontation is not trying to keep your get your spouse to think you're okay. Willingness to deal with yourself, or in our language, repent, is that you go into crisis with yourself about the kind of person you are and the impact you are having. And you start dealing with the truth in it that others around you are trying to point you towards. Now, the fact is always going to be that the people around you have their own blind spots, their own limitations, their ways that they make it so tempting and so justifiable to do exactly what you like to do. But that is, you deal with the beam in your own eye.
Yeah.
You deal with who you are. And if you have a spouse that just is either always trying to get you to see them as good, always trying to argue for how you're wrong rather than how they're wrong, and doesn't, maybe miserable, but never goes into that, "Oh my gosh, they're right." It's going to be a tough go to have a happy marriage. And, you know, everybody out there now is married to a narcissist. Everybody thinks their spouse is a narcissist. And everybody's a little bit right, because we are all born narcissistic and we all have some level of self-blindness and self-justification. But the measure of a workable marriage is always that willingness to deal with yourself, even in the face of your spouse's glaring challenges.
Yeah. And I think that it's interesting because I feel like unless you're really, really good at this, I feel like the feelings of wanting to push it off onto something else, either onto a spouse or onto some external situation, is a natural thing to do.
Absolutely.
Because it's scary. And
absolutely it is.
But the idea is, can we overcome those feelings of fear to really address what we need to address within ourselves?
Yes. And, you know, I always say that's what actual faith is, in my view. It's like the willingness to tolerate what is true, even though it's rocking your world. It's, you know, destabilizing your view of yourself, perhaps your view of your marriage, and to tolerate what is true over what feels good or feels familiar. And so, again, our minds are so good. You know, I remember one of the Stephen R. Covey principles is, seek first to understand, then be understood. Very simple idea, very difficult to execute.
Right.
Because if you seek first to understand, you're going to get data in there that doesn't match your current map and will probably, on some level, destabilize your current map. None of us like that. It's disorganizing, but it helps you have a clearer map. And so what I see people do often is just they resist that reorientation. They resist that expansion of their map. But then they're going around blind, and then they get convinced that their partner is the problem, and then often go and recreate it. Now, it's not always true, and I don't want to say, like, look, it's always you, but it's, in my experience, the more people clean up their side of the street, the more they find out what the marriage is capable of, because they're not polluting it with their own liabilities. And often the marriage becomes a much better one because they're dealing with themselves. What also happens is people clean up their side of the street. If the marriage doesn't evolve and they truly are dealing with their own difficulty with love, their own difficulty with really caring for another person when they don't get validation from that person, and they really, truly have a spouse who won't deal with themselves, well, then they can make a decision from the best in themselves rather than the regressed, injured, you know, self-justified part of themselves. And, you know, divorce is more dangerous when you do it from that self-blind place, because it's just easy to go recreate the problem.
Right, right. How do you suggest couples move and navigate divorce when the desire to divorce is one-sided?
I don't really know what the answer is that you're looking for on that, because I guess I would just say, this is clearly a situation in which you're not going to get the validation of the other person.
Right.
Often what a good marriage requires, and ultimately what divorce requires, is the ability to deal with aloneness. And we don't tend to think of that as what a good marriage requires.
Sure.
But the ability to make a decision and handle your own anxiety and your own aloneness in a decision that you make, or in a decision that someone else makes.
Mm-hmm.
Something I see people do in divorce all the time, and is an exposure of their difficulty with this, is as soon as divorce is on the table, people start going to get allies, people right. that will collude in their narrative that justifies, he's a jerk for leaving, I'm justified in leaving, whatever the story is, that they need people to come in and validate, because they are struggling to deal with their own sense of guilt, their own sense of having something to do with what's been wrong in this decision or in this marriage. And so they're often going and looking for people to collude in their simple-minded story because of the difficulty of taking full responsibility for themselves in a divorce.
I do have a question about that, because as you're talking about it, I guess I wonder, do individuals have clear ideas about what they want out of a marriage, what they're willing to contribute, what that arrangement looks like? And then is divorce kind of part of that inability to reconcile whatever it is they had in their mind that they wanted to achieve by that union?
Yeah, absolutely. Most people have implicit goals that don't become explicit unless there's a lot of suffering. So what I mean is there's often an implicit goal when people marry, especially when they marry young, which is on some level, you will validate me, you will make me happy, you will give me a sense of being special and important and chosen, desirable. And we're looking in a way for a surrogate parent in the name of an intimate partner. Very few of us are thinking, I'm choosing to marry this person that's quite different than me, who's going to want different things, and that's going to frustrate me. And yet I still choose it because I'm willing to embrace the way that's going to stretch me and pressure me to grow into someone who's capable of holding on to herself or himself and capable of love. And, you know, I was talking to my siblings recently because we were together, and I was saying, you know, when you really think about how different men and women are often and how different their kind of biologically wired goals are around sexuality and around relationships, you know, there's a high demand on what it is to actually partner with somebody. And usually what we do is we go in and we assume, well, my way is the right way. And why can't you validate my way? And what is it going to take to get you to be the right kind of person? And we just instinctively do that, you know? I'm going to give you some feedback, right? Okay. Well,
I just love that you called it feedback. That's awesome. That's so good.
Here's a feedback sandwich. I'm going to start with, you know, the nice thing, and then I'm going to give you what I really mean in the middle. And then I'll, so anyway. And, you know, it's not that there's nothing true in what we're saying, but it's that we don't actually want, like, okay, I've actually committed to God to love this person, even though he or she wants different things, sees sexuality different than me. And so how do we, I mean, in the best couples, how do we work together to create something that we can both thrive in? Mm-hmm. Because that's going to stretch both of you. What we often want to do is, okay, I'm going to prevail. I'm going to win at this. You need to do what makes me comfortable. There's a lot of ways we do this. I mean, this is going back to your earlier question around what are ways that people don't self-confront. Well, a lot of ways is I'm the victim here, or, you know, the kind of what we sometimes teach women is men are supposed to make you happy by providing a life for you, and you kind of are their backup and their support staff. You know, mm-hmm. that's the kind of the traditional idea. But then the idea is, well, it's the Cinderella idea. Well, where's my castle? Where's my horse? Where's the, like, making me happy? Because I've given up so much. And these are often implicit contracts. But the way you pressure, you know, the masculine in that particular version is, I'm not happy and it's your fault. And so it's a way of saying, it's not me, it's you. I'm the victim of your poor ability to be a husband. So, you know, we're often coming in looking for what we're going to get much more than what we're going to give. The people who are happy are thinking about how do we both thrive and what's that going to ask of me? Very simple version of this is just Christmas traditions. Okay. It was like what time you go to bed, how clean the house is. These are, you can see pretty quickly who's prevailing in the family because whose traditions are being followed, whose nighttime routine is the standard. You know, or are you finding out some way to work with each other and be decent to each other and say, it's not all about me. It's also not all about you.
You said the word prevailing, and I'm just going to co-op a term that President Nelson used. Do you think there's a good way that couples or a good framework that they can use to let God prevail in their marriage?
The way I think of it is, if you're going to have a good marriage, what you're committing to is you're committing to God, not to the other person. Now, what I mean by that is you're committing to God about the kind of person you're going to be, the way you're going to live up to the standard around being a person who is willing to face herself, who's willing to grow, who's willing to love another person. And so you're making a commitment to growing into a loving person vis-a-vis the one you're partnering with. Right. Mm-hmm. And so is your spouse, ideally. And that's really what it is, you know, that we're committing to the best in ourselves for this marriage. And so how my ego is not as important, right, as what is best in me, as what is honest in me and what is actually fair and loving. And so really, you know, natural man is ego, not sexuality. Natural man is self preoccupation and, you know, managing how we feel and how others see us, rather than really learning to care for another person and not concern ourselves so much with how we're seen. And so that's what I think we're committing to when we say God is our is at the center of our marriage. It's less about, you know, compliance with a particular standard or something, and much more about what we are creating through our religious observance, what we're creating in ourselves through the way we relate to what God would have us do.
Maybe as we shift gears a little bit, again, when Burgess and Tyson and I were asked the questions, hey, I'm starting to date post-divorce and I'm terrified. All three of us, I think I spat out some really bad advice on that episode.
Yeah. It's really all we do on this podcast is just spat out bad advice. I mean, we're experts in that arena. So
yeah,
we all really. Yeah. I mean,
what are some things that you've seen in clients that again who are going through divorce? Like, what? How have people who are in healthy marriages and good relationships? How are they there for them in ways that aren't? The ways that are helpful, what's been helpful, what's not been helpful, as from your stance as a marriage therapist?
One thing I would probably say is just on some level to have compassion for no matter how difficult that marriage was, your friend is going through a big loss.
For sure.
Because even though it may be the most right choice, there may even be some relief in a marriage ending, there's also been a tremendous loss of what you thought the marriage could be, of a shared history, of a shared reality, of hope, a loss of hope, you know? And so, you know, often people divorcing are dealing with a lot of grief, even if they're clear that it's the right choice. And so right. Acknowledging some of that there's a death in a sense of a reality, and it can be painful. The other thing I would say, that's what would be helpful, I was to acknowledge that. I think it can be about processing the meaning of what's happening and being a listening ear for a friend. So I'm going with what is good. Okay, I'll talk about that in a minute. I'm going in the opposite order. I think being willing to kind of understand and be the friend, you know, often the person going through divorce feels very lonely, feels disoriented, and is looking for a way to make sense of what has happened, especially if the person is being divorced out of a betrayal, right? So that is that they are being left. They are having someone who's saying, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Right.
And so they may well be looking for a way to make sense of who they are, why this happened. Now, you may not feel qualified, but even just trying to listen is important. The one caveat I would give is this idea that oftentimes people are trying to marshal reinforcement at the detriment of their growth. Like, I want to justify myself. I want to see it this way. I want people on my side. I want people to fight for my side. And it's just tricky. I mean,
right.
What the best friends do is they help you with what you don't see. You know, they help you with what might help you to understand, like, say somebody who feels guilty, but it really isn't their fault, the divorce. Okay. Well, a good friend is going to say, look, I don't think this person ever treated you well. And I don't think they ever were going to. And I really don't genuinely think it's your problem. Okay. That's a friend.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be being cautious about agreeing and validating a narrative where you feel like the friend is just wanting justification. And right. If you don't, I mean, it's tricky because they may not be asking you, do you agree with me? But you want to be careful that you're not operating collusively because you feel like a good friend will just go along with what they're saying, even if you think it's self-destructive in some way. So I'm not sure what that looks like, but you know, sometimes I have friends who reach out that are not necessarily looking for anyone to talk honestly to them. And then I have friends who are really looking for honest input. And you know, sometimes I'll assess what level they want me to talk to them. But I think it can be really helpful when you have friends who help you see what you don't see. Yeah. Because even that can be helpful in the next relationship if you can wake up to parts of yourself that have been a part of a poor relationship.
What is some good advice that people can do to reacclimate themselves as, you know, going through the divorce, kind of reestablishing their life as a single person, and then reentering dating and relationships?
Could I add a layer to that question? I'm curious if you could add to that. Is divorce kind of a misnomer? Do we ever really divorce from that person? Is that person remain a part of us, you know, in some fashion, regardless of kind of how we move forward?
Yeah, well, I would say if you have no children, I mean, you never fully, you know, it's not like you just erase the reality of this person sharing a lot of yourself and your life with a person. I do think you really can move on if you don't have children. If you have children, you know, the reality is, and I'm not saying this means people shouldn't divorce sometimes, but you don't really ever divorce. You now are partnering in raising children, usually, unless one has full custody, with somebody that now is angry, okay, that now, you know, whatever difficulties you had in marriage are often magnified in divorce. And again, I'm not saying that doesn't mean it's still not the right choice sometimes.
Right.
But it is an illusion to think that this person is no longer in your life and there is no real going backwards when you have children with someone, but it still may be the right thing to do.
Like, well, I guess what kind of tips would you have for people, again, making that transition from, again, married to divorced, again, kind of reestablishing their identity and then getting back into dating?
Yeah. Thank you for reiterating. So I think that, first of all, what I would recommend is time not dating. Time with yourself. Time kind of reestablishing a relationship to who you are, to what your goals are. You know, who you are in a certain context can be really shaped by that relationship. And especially if that relationship was pulling at you in ways that kind of undermined your integrity or the best in yourself. And so, you know, I've worked with people who've divorced and they just really kind of made a commitment not to date for a period of time, especially, you know, in some situations where dating was where they would go instinctively, almost to kind of fill the vacuum of their aloneness. They would go kind of quickly go find somebody. And it was especially important to not do that. To have a little time sort of tolerating aloneness, establishing a relationship to oneself, not filtered through how other people feel or filtered getting comfort from another person. And so, so I think that recalibrating is important, especially if you have children, to be slow to involve another person. Because your kids will be reeling from the divorce, even if on some level they're grateful it happened.
Yeah.
They're trying to sort out their lives, their sense of security. And you want to be slow about bringing another person that they have to make room for, accommodate. No, I would recommend with children that you keep dating when it does start to happen private for, you know, as private. I don't mean to say that you would be lying to them, but I mean that you're not having them meet the person, that you're not having them build a relationship until you're pretty sure you want this to move forward. And to not forget that this person will affect your children. It is not just about what you desire, but you are the steward of how others impact your children. And to be very, very careful about that. You know, I remember thinking when my kids were younger that if my husband ever died and I was, you know, that I would, whatever it took, stay single until they were out of the house. Because I've just seen how much it can challenge kids to have to accommodate other partners' children, you know, and that sometimes what the parent wants is not as important as that first responsibility to their kids. But I think when it's time to date and you feel you're ready to move into a relationship, you want to know what your blind spots are. You want to know where your vulnerabilities are. Gosh, I'm always attracted to this kind of person because it reinforces me in this immediate sense. Right. Right. I've had people like they're always looking for the damsel in distress because it makes them feel like the strong guy, the one that's so able. And women who are more there, you know, more equal to them or don't need them, they're afraid of those relationships. And so, but then they start to, the problem with their first partnership was that they resented that person because it was always pulling on this, over-functioning part of them. But then it's very easy in the vulnerability of partnership to want to need to be needed, right? And to step right back into some version of that. The reciprocal is a woman who's like often looking for these one-up guys, worked with somebody who's in a really bad relationship. He was psychologically abusive and she finally gets out of it. But then she like starts dating and she just sort of like, how do I keep finding these guys? She keeps like finding these ones that would condescend to or patronize. Mm-hmm. And she was often attracted to the ones that didn't treat her well, because if they didn't treat her well, they must get who she really is. And so for her, it was working through.
That's tough.
I wasn't treated well by my brothers. I wasn't treated well by my parents. I learned to see myself as insufficient. And so when there's men out there that actually treat me well, I feel like they don't really know me or something, or they think I'm better than I actually am, when in reality, they can probably see more properly than the men who need to condescend do. And so that awareness can allow you to shift your behavior. Look, I'm doing that again. Okay, here I am. And what do I need to do? Like in one case, it's in my head where she'd learn to not speak honestly. She'd learn to accommodate and manage and she started practicing speaking more honestly and truthfully in the relationships. And men that didn't want that would leave. And then she found somebody who wanted a real partner, wanted someone where she could bring her more honest self. So it's really practicing muscles that have been limited in you, but increase your ability to thrive and to love in a marriage. And so the more self-aware you are, the more likely you are to not repeat the pattern at the same level as your first partnership.
How hard is it to find someone that really will be, you'll be able to find a meaningful marriage with? Do we kind of approach it a little too lightly sometimes?
I do think we approach it lightly. Like some of us think more about what car we're going to buy than the person we're going to spend a lot
I know. And,
I didn't do that. I was pretty afraid of marrying and not being pretty deliberate about it. But I think it's something we do need to be thoughtful about. But it's not about finding the perfect match in the sense of like, we're going to like the same things, the same things, like the same shows. It's more about you want to be someone who's capable of love. And what I mean by that is investing in another person's well-being, but holding your dignity, not needing to be needed so much that you're sacrificing yourself and trying to earn your lovability. That's not love. Okay. So, but that you need to be someone capable of love, and you need to be willing to look for someone who also will love you and will make room for you to thrive. I mean, when you say how hard is it? I don't know, actually. I mean, I'm working with pretty normal people who are struggling with a lot of these things. So I do think in some ways, as Dr. Schnarch used to say, nothing prepares you for marriage. Marriage prepares you for marriage. Just like nothing prepares you for parenting. That baby is the one that's preparing you for parenting. Waking you up all night and everything else. So sometimes it's the being in it. What I would say is, again, it's going back to the willingness to let the marriage teach you, the humility of saying, this is going to hurt sometimes and nothing's going wrong. I remember in my first year of marriage, I was like, we are sometimes fighting. We are not just, and look at all these other people at church. They all look like they're just getting along perfectly. What's wrong with us? Okay. Not a helpful idea. Completely unhelpful. Okay. First of all, it's just not true, because now that I'm in the chair that I'm in, I'm like, oh, okay.
Get to peek behind the curtain, right?
I get to look under the hood a bit. You're like, well, that's, you know. So, but then secondly, it's not helpful because it's like, no, this is what marriage is. You're joining your life with another person with a different history, with different inclinations, different ways of thinking, different ways of believing and living. And so this is not a small task. We're not just going to move in together and get along on every front. If you're going to be honest, you know, there's going to be points of friction. It's not about friction that's the problem. It's how you handle the friction. John Gottman did some research that said this is not about the amount of difference in a couple that determines happiness. It's how you deal with difference. Do you resent it? Do you get self-justified and try to change the other person? Do you just collapse into what the other person wants? You know, how functionally are you handling that friction between the two of you? And the ideal, the happiest marriages have a certain respect for those differences and are looking for ways to be fair in the face of those differences. Fair to both.
Yeah.
We use a model sometimes around serve your partner. And I get what we're pointing at when we're saying that. The only thing is that when only one person's doing that, it's often the person that's like needs to be needed is sort of erasing themselves to keep the other person happy. And it doesn't end up actually working towards a thriving marriage.
Mm.
And I think this idea of how do we make room for both of us to live good lives while together, right? How do we not ask too much from the other, but how do we not ask too little for ourselves? And so is there a way to build a bridge across these differences and to respect that they're there for a reason? I mean, we're drawn to the person because they're different. I'm an extrovert. My husband's an introvert, right? I'm, you know, more feeling and emotive. My husband's more stoic and quiet. But I wasn't attracted to the feeling emotive guys ever. I mean, I thought they were nice, but that was not what would kind of grab me. So you have to respect, like this is exactly who I chose. So don't resent him for being exactly what I was attracted to. That's so not good. Fair.
Yeah.
That's hard introspection, though, you know?
You're expecting us to be like really good humans.
Yeah, right.
That's hard, Dr. Finlayson 5.
Exactly.
I love what you're saying. I think that... one thing, I've had a couple of people close to me in the past recently who have gone through pretty out of the blue divorces. And as I've watched them, you know, go through this journey and putting myself in there, it's really hard and really scary. I feel like I would just latch onto anyone that would give me after, you know, years of having a relationship where I'm, you know, that isn't unhappy functioning or, well. Yeah. Yes. That finally, when I finally find someone that gives me some sort of positive reinforcement who kind of likes me, you know, I would be afraid that I would just jump head in
To that. Right.
So, and I think that, I mean, because chemically speaking, you know, falling in love for the first time is driven more by biology than it is by really anything else.
Your prefrontal, I don't know.
How do you, you know, what kind of advice would you have to people to keep the goggles at least in focus as much as they can?
So first of all, absolutely true. And the needier we are, the more we can rush in. You know, it's like...
very needy right here, for sure. For sure. You weren't specifically talking about me, but yes, self-confronting here. Yes, for sure.
Dr. Schnarch used to say, like, the more we need validation, right, the needier we are, the less we're likely to get it. So that is to say, the more we're just craving to get it where we can get it, first of all, somebody who's more stable is not going to be attracted to that. It's too needy, right? Mm-hmm. And the person who can feel the neediness can take advantage of it, right? So it is risky on many fronts, because precisely the psychological position you're in, not only is it going and grabbing the first option there, but often the person that will actually receive that is needy themselves. That is, they need to be needed, or, you know, they want that, they're coming at it from a place of minimal development. So, and I think you're on point when you're saying that the loss associated with the divorce, the aloneness, can make it really easy to kind of take the comfort that's available to you. I think, you know, if I were suddenly single, what I would do is, first of all, say, like, I owe it to myself to find in my friendships, in my family relationships, in people that care about me, the social sustenance I need so that I am not rushing to find connection to fill the void.
Mm.
So I know I would be thinking, like, I need to manage this vulnerability in me so that I don't get ahead of myself.
Right.
And so I would just be thinking about, how am I going to do this in a way that I can, you know, not let my biology or my neediness run the show. And so, yeah, I would, it's like any vulnerability, like you're an alcoholic or something. You're like, okay, how do I structure my life and my choices that my lower brain doesn't hijack my upper brain.
Right.
And the more deliberate we are, the better our decision-making can be.
Well, we're coming up on time. In terms of, like, doctrine of the church, mm-hmm. you know, we have, you know, that part in the Bible where Jesus says, save any divorce is not sanctioned of God unless it's having to do with fornication or whatever. And I know mm-hmm. that the decision to divorce is much more nuanced than that. Mm. But doctrinally speaking, how do you look at the decision to divorce, the process of divorce, and things like that? Not necessarily to doctrinally validate what people do, but what kind of teachings in the church do you see that would help reconcile the difficulty of divorce and the topic of it, really?
I don't know if I have a great answer for that, because I'm just thinking doctrinally, like, can I think of specific scriptures? Or what I think more about is this commandment to love, right? Mm-hmm. And what does it mean to love? And what does it mean to commit to loving? Well, there is a certain amount of non-conditionality that's a part of that choice, you know, to step into a commitment. When you have a child, you are promising God that you are going to love and shepherd and care for this person, even if they disappoint you, even if you think they reflect badly on you, even if they have special needs. You're basically saying, I promise, right, that I am going to, my soul will be stretched. This will be hard. This won't feel good. But I believe in the higher good in this. And that's where my commitment is that I will do my part. I will do my job here, even if it doesn't always feel good. I think in marriage, the one thing that maybe a simpler interpretation might be, well, then that means it doesn't matter what effect it has on your soul to be in the relationship.
Right.
You still have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see love quite like that. I mean, on the one hand, I don't want to justify the indulgent me focus that we can readily have in our society today. Like, you know, if I'm not comfortable, I don't have to do it. Because we're certainly not as commitment focused as we were, you know, 50 years ago or more. So sure. I think that, but I think the question is, you know, I've worked with people that are in situations in which they're with someone who is psychologically manipulative and
right,
and being there is eroding their souls. It's eroding their children, right? It is not loving to stay and keep propping up the abusive reality. It's not mm-hmm. loving. So what I think about what love is what you do, what you sacrifice for, creates strength in the other. Right. You're sacrificing maybe your own ego or whatever for the benefit of someone else's growth and expansion. But propping up weakness is weakness.
Right.
It is not love. So a lot of times we use the idea Christ-like of basically be a doormat. Let people take advantage of you. It's all right. good. And you're going to get your reward in the next life. And that's just not true. There's an indulgence in that. There's even an ego need in that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not about creating the greater good. And so we have to be thinking about, is what I'm doing actually making my spouse stronger? Is it making me stronger? Is what I'm doing in fact loving? And again, I think usually what it is we have to learn to be more loving in the pressure points of marriage. But, you know, it's hard for me to give you, oh, here are the rules when you get divorced. But I think it's when you know you really are doing your part and you genuinely in your soul know it's true and know that it's not good for you to stay. Then I think it's saying it's because, you know, I've sometimes in working with people, you know, it's like, no, I want a marriage. That's why I'm divorcing. I want to love and be loved. That's why this isn't working. And I mean that you recognize that what you're involved in is not actually creating something meaningful and important.
Enabling you to love God and love your fellow men, including your spouse, including your family, including yourself.
That's right. So, you know, that's why I like the idea of marriage as being a commitment to God vis-a-vis the other person, because you can't betray the best in yourself and have it be loving. You can't undermine your own soul, your own integrity, your own honesty, and have it be love. That's codependency, right? That's actually propping up weakness out of weakness in you. That's a commitment to a person rather than the best in yourself and facilitating the best in the other. So we just don't want to confuse those two.
Right.
That doesn't mean you have to divorce, but you have to at least look at what am I actually doing in the name of love?
And maybe also just involving God in that decision, right? Involving God in the decision to get married. And if it comes to that, involving God in the decision to or to not get divorced.
Absolutely. Right. And looking to wise others to help you in that. Not people that just, you know, reinforce your view that you want, but are helping you see what you don't see, either in you or in your marriage, so that you're really bringing your most solid judgment to that kind of decision.
But one thing we didn't let you at the very beginning, I was just very excited to talk to you. I didn't ask you about if you have anything going on, where can we find you, anything that you're offering our listeners?
Sure. Let me think. I think that we have like three retreats in the fall, four retreats, actually. I believe three of them are sold out, but I do think we have some tickets left for the Art of Loving retreat. I may be wrong about that. There may not be any left, but this is a men's retreat that will be in St. George in October or maybe November. All right. I don't remember, but it's in the fall. And we did this in Oregon last year and it was phenomenal. So it's the content of my men's course, which is a self and sexual development course and learning how to love through sexuality and to have more confidence because of what it is you're bringing through your sexuality. A lot of times men are taught to just be ambivalent towards sexuality because they think of it as something indulgent or anti-spiritual or self-serving, and then aren't able to really grow into being really good lovers. And by that, I mean really loving and blessing in a sense through their sexuality. And so that's what that course is. So I think there's room in that live workshop. And then I have my online courses, but maybe what I'd focus on right now is Room for Two is a subscription-based podcast where I'm working with real couples around the challenges that are very common in marriage. I mean, so many people say to me like, oh my gosh, I relate to every couple because, you know, we're human beings and we're doing very human things. And so you're seeing me work with couples around how they're participating in the problem and what my feedback is to them. So people have found it helpful because first it normalizes, it makes them feel less like they're uniquely broken. But second, it helps them see themselves and see like, oh, okay, I can see what I've been doing and I'm a part of this marital issue. And so it allows them without having to go sit with, you know, a coach or a therapist to address something in themselves. So that's called Room for Two, that podcast. And you can find everything I do on my website.
Thank you so much. We love having you on.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I'm glad we were able to work out a schedule to have you on. So
yeah. Yeah, me too. Good.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Thanks, you
guys. Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
You're very welcome. Yeah, bye-bye.
So what did you think?
Dr. Jenner from the Finlayson 5 is just a walking soundbite. There were so many good like one-liners. I could have talked about self-confrontation a lot more, but I know that wasn't the point of the podcast. But I think that the ability, like, we've talked a lot about self-confrontation with her in terms of how to do that as a spouse, how to do that as you talk about important things with important people, and now to look for it as a sign of, you know, whether or not you're in a good relationship. You know, are you able to self-confront? Is your partner able to self-confront? Or again, are those concerns and things being rerouted to avoid accountability?
Right.
Which I thought was fascinating.
I thought there was, she didn't go too deep into this, but I actually, like, my mind kept going back to it. This idea of a person's map. Because I've had this thought before that a lot of times I think what individuals do to varying levels is they look at a person and they say, oh, this person fits in really good with this roadmap that I have for myself. Mm-hmm. Not expecting that person to impact that roadmap. It's just a very nice fit, like a puzzle piece kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And so just willing to, you know, let that roadmap be lead where it will, you know, mm-hmm. As you collaborate with that person and build a life together, I think is a beautiful thing. I think sometimes we just get so involved in our own plans that we don't allow something, you know, unknown and exciting and, you know, ultimately better to happen because we're so set on the things that we have in our head right now. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I would have liked to have heard her opinion a little bit more about, you know, commitment and our comfort level.
Sure.
And what that, how she sees that in our society and in our culture now. Because marriage is not designed for our comfort. We want it to be, but you know, Nate and Angela and Bagley said the same thing. Marriage drives us to a place where we need to grow. And a lot of the times that requires self-sacrifice, that requires, you know, being able to be tolerant of discomfort and tolerant of hard feelings and wading through resentment and, you know, what that's done to marriage. And what that does to marriages now, you know, I think it would have been an interesting thing to, but you know, we're coming up on time. So,
well, it was, you know, it's interesting about that is that in order to be, you know, I'm just going to use the word patient, you know, mm-hmm. or maybe long suffering is another word you could use for that. In order to do that, you have to have something in place that allows you to build those muscles. Our problem is that there's no, like, everything is so immediate, right? I mean, she talked about, you know, she kind of quipped about someone taking longer on a decision to buy a car than to get married, right? And, you know, how many cars do we go through? You know, how many houses mm-hmm. do we go through? Buying a house is a life-changing experience, and how many houses do we buy? You know, I think the average is someone stays in a house for like 3 to 5 years.
Before, oh, seriously?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's horrible. I think it's interesting. I agree. It would have been interesting to hear her talk about it, but I also kind of feel it's just a given. Like, just look around you. There's nothing, mm-hmm. there's nothing around us. You can get credit for anything. And that mm-hmm. allows you to treat everything as both disposable and acquirable at a minute's notice. So, mm-hmm. does that extend into our marriages? I think for some people it does. Even if we're not quick to divorce, I think we sometimes, that muscle memory of I want this now gets into our marriage relationship and can influence our behavior. And so I think we just need to be aware of it and say, you know, I'm just going to practice saying no to myself in a healthy way, on certain things, and try and be, look more eternally. You know, 80 years here is nothing. It is absolutely nothing. But we can build a lot of eternal muscles if we use that time the right way.
What I also found interesting was the, you know, how to navigate being a true friend versus a colluder in someone's, I guess, garrison to get people on your side, their side.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. That's a tough line to walk as well. But again, I think it goes back to, all goes back to, again, what she said is, you know, act in ways that have, that are, that increase your ability to love God and love his children. And that's where we should focus all of our, all, like those, our actions and how we, you know, live any commandment and any way of our lives should be first seen through those two lenses. How does it, how can I better help God? Or how can I better help love God and love his children?
I agree. And I think too, I mean, I think this is just generally a good piece of advice. Don't, I think we should not be too eager to hand out advice, right? To reach into our, yeah, to our advice drawer and pick out the right one. I've heard from some other people that, as an example, you know, friends start to really be concerned about you, like if you go through a life-changing event like a divorce, you know, and they want to see you happy, and that means, oh, I need to set you up with someone, or, you know, you're even their children, right? You know, mm-hmm. So I mean, you know, all of a sudden your children are very concerned about you, you know, mom, dad, you really need to get married, or, you know, this, that, or the other thing. And so sometimes it's just enough to express your love and your care for them, and mm-hmm. let them kind of feel it out for themselves. Ultimately, they're going to have to live with whatever decision they decide to make. And if you do decide to give some advice, just keep in mind that I think what they want most is your friendship, and don't listen to anything we say on this podcast.
Honestly, you guys should have stopped when we said, thanks a lot, Dr. Finlayson Fife. So, but that's great. Well, last episode of the season for the summer for before our hiatus, any parting words, any last sage advice?
After what I just said?
True. We'll see you in a few months. Burgess will also... Burgess isn't dead, by the way. He is just sick.
We're definitely not using AI to keep Burgess in the episodes. That's definitely not happening.
That would be legit awesome, though. Have Terminator Burgess.
Right.
We'll just like type stuff up and we'll have his own voice. Ooh, yeah. Who could write the best Burgess? That I think that's a question that we'll
ChatGPT.
Yeah,
that's the answer.
Write in the voice of Burgess Caulfield a goodbye to everyone for the season.
So we've got enough samples now that I'm sure like we could just AI all the rest of our episodes and it would be pretty accurate.
Hey. That would be great.
You should see Johnny right now. He's like heavy into this idea.
I am opening up ChatGPT right now to see if it will write something in the voice of Burgess Caulfield. Like, I wonder if Burgess has a big enough presence on the internet. I don't know. Should we? Is this worth our time to keep trying right now, or should I just publish the episode or publish the results on Instagram?
Yeah, we could do that, or we could, you know, that could be our intro to our next episode or something.
All right. Well, again, thanks for, we'll see you next summer. We're definitely planning on coming back. At least I am. I have not discussed this with Tyson yet. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Verbal confirmation that it'll at least be Tyson and me.
We're not divorcing.
I assume we'll be fine.
That would have been way too ironic. Oh yeah. By the way, we're breaking up.
We're breaking up as a band. Yeah.
Which is why we were talking about divorce. just wanted to make it easier for Tyson to segue into it.
I'm gonna stop right there. Thanks again to Dr. Finlayson Fife, and again, thanks to you for joining us this season. As a reminder, please make sure you're subscribed to the show, and we'll see you next season.
Please bless us to get home safely.